Hey there, I'm Zen Hess. You are listening to Currents in Religion, a podcast brought to you by the Department of Religion at Baylor University and by Baylor University Press. Thanks for joining me today. Christians confess Jesus is God, but Christians haven't always agreed on what it means for Jesus to be God. What kind of God is Jesus? Is he a God like the God of Israel, unbegotten and uncreated? Or is he some other kind of God? In this podcast, I talk with Mike Bird about how ancient Jewish and Greco-Roman folks thought about what makes a God a God, about how the New Testament writings portray Jesus as a God, and about how the creeds that attempted to sort out questions about Jesus as a God relate to all of this. Mike Bird is the academic dean and lecturer in theology and New Testament at Ridley College in Melbourne, Australia. He is also the author of Jesus Among the Gods, a new book with Baylor University Press. By the way, Mike made time to talk with me while we were in Denver for AARSBL. We walked all around the Colorado Convention Center, looking for a somewhat quiet place to record our conversation. Eventually, we snuck into an empty, cordoned-off cafeteria, where things were mostly quiet, but we found out a little ways into the interview that it was cordoned off because they were doing some construction on that side of the convention center. So I apologize in advance for some of the banging that you might hear in the background, though I bet you'll be so gripped by what Mike's saying, you won't even notice the noise. Enjoy the conversation, and don't forget to share this episode with someone you think will love it. Dr. Mike Bird, thank you for joining us on Currents in Religion here at AARSBL.
Thank you, Zen, and to all your listeners, it's a pleasure to be on your program.
Now, I've been at the Baylor University Press booth for most of the event, and your book has been selling quite a lot, so congratulations on that. Talking today about Jesus Among the Gods. And your book contributes to the debate about how Christianity came to talk about Jesus as a God. Could you give us a kind of short and sweet summary of that debate in New Testament studies?
Well, the issue is, why do Christians worship Jesus as God, or as an expression of the one true God? Now, there's one narrative in scholarship that argues Jesus was merely a man. It was believed he rose from the dead and then he would return. But it took some time for the early church to really attribute divinity to him. Mm-hmm. So they might talk about him having heavenly powers, maybe some divine functions. Maybe they could describe him really like a bit of an angel, you know, with a fleshly appearance. But they would say he doesn't really become God until you get to the Gospel of John. And even John's idea of Jesus as a divine, I mean, he's divine, but he's not divine in the same way as God the Father. Because, you know, in John's Gospel, even Jesus says the Father is greater than I. Mm-hmm. And then he really gets made fully divine in the 4th century with the Council of Nicaea and Athanasius. So that's one narrative that goes along.
And what's the other?
The other narratives, you get people like Richard Baucom arguing that, you know, Jesus from the very beginning was regarded as possessing a divine identity. So that is, he participates in the things that make Israel's God uniquely God. You know, particularly, having the divine name, Yahweh, or it would be Kurios in Greek. And he participates in that creator-creature distinction. Mm. Others say, no, it's all about the type of worship he receives. I mean, you know, forget all the titles and, you know, identity is a complicated category. I mean, Jesus is worshipped with cultic worship, the type of worship you would give to the Most High God. And some of the worship offered to Jesus matches that. I mean, but the problem is the very word worship, you know, can be kind of ambiguous. I mean, right. You can have sort of, you know, genuine prostration before someone. I mean, you know, angels can receive certain types of veneration. Mm-hmm. So is Jesus just venerated like an angel? Right. Others want to talk about divine functions. Like, you know, Jesus is involved in salvation. He's involved in judgment, mm-hmm. that kind of a thing. And then there's others who argue argue that the relationship between the church and Jesus is kind of similar between the church and Israel. So that's all the question. How and why does the early church regard Jesus as divine? And that's the debate I came to, and that's where I wanted to try and make my own contribution to this very contested topic.
Yes, and you it seems like you have. And one of the things that you suggest is that in the era in which the New Testament writings were being composed, Jews and Greeks both were interested in conversations about divine ontology, about the nature of what it means to be a God. So just for context, let's say that a Roman philosopher, a Jewish rabbi, and a Christian missionary walk into a coffee shop, perhaps, or would you prefer a pub?
Probably a pub, since I really don't like coffee. I'm not
That's
a coffee drinker.
That's what I've heard. Okay, so they walk into a pub in the first century, and they start talking about what makes a God a God. Could you help us understand what they agree on and perhaps what their most important disagreements are?
Well, I think a number of things they would agree on are the basic categories of divinity. Now, in the ancient world, they seem to have divided gods into two types. Mm-hmm. Those that were unbegotten or uncreated, and those who were begotten, or shall we say, promoted into divinity. And I can give Greco-Roman and Jewish views of either one. So an unbegotten god would be in the Roman or Greek and Roman realm would be something like Zeus or Jupiter or called Dios.
Yeah.
This is an uncreated god. So this is like an eternal god who is always there and has an absolute status. Now, mm-hmm. there's, you know, sort of tales of, you know, anthropomorphic appearances or transformations into human form, that kind of thing. But Zeus is an absolute god. And then you have, you know, gods who get promoted, like, you know, Heracles.
Right.
Or Asclepius, or in some accounts, even Isis. So maybe people get promoted from humanity into divinity, or a Roman emperor who gets deified upon death.
Right.
You know, Julius Caesar becomes the divine Julius Caesar, and his heir on earth becomes the son of the divine Julius. So you've got these two categories. And in the Jewish world, I think you've got a little bit of the same. You've got Yahweh, you know, the God of Israel, the God of the covenant, the God of creation, the God of the Torah, who is an absolute divinity, who is the creator, who is uncreated. But then you get people who can ascend to heaven, like an Enoch or an Elijah. And sometimes the saints, the patriarchs, are described as having angelic qualities in a post-mortem state. So you could say that's been like a begotten God, or you're promoted within a divine spectrum, if you like. But there's that gap between unbegotten deities and begotten deities. And then the Christian would say, well, I believe all that. I believe there is the one unbegotten God, and I believe that unbegotten God became human in the person of Jesus. Did not merely, you know, morph or appear as a human being, but took on the very flesh and the murk and mire of human existence with all the bodily functions of a human being and participated in humanity. And this is why you get someone like Ignatius of Antioch in the early second century saying Jesus is unbegotten in his divinity, but begotten in his humanity. So you can see some Christians are making a very strong claim that Jesus is not promoted into divinity, but he's an absolute divine being because he is on the unbegotten side of the ledger. But the debate, of course, is that consistent in every Christian document? I mean, I would argue Hebrews, John definitely see Jesus as an unbegotten deity. But what about the Apostle Paul? What about the Gospel of Mark? Do they regard Jesus as an unbegotten or a begotten deity? And that's where I start using this sort of duality, or this sort of, you know, dual taxonomy as a way of looking about divine claims made about Jesus by the first Christians.
You are listening to Currents in Religion. We're speaking with Mike Bird, author of Jesus Among the Gods, a new book from Baylor University Press.
So that's the kind of the question of divine ontology. And then you've got another chapter that weighs in at 266 pages, where you are looking at just countless examples of what you call intermediary figures, which often are also used to kind of explain how the New Testament texts talk about Jesus. Could you talk to us a little bit about those intermediary figures and give us maybe some of the ones that were standouts for you or most interesting to you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so here's the thing. Instead of saying Jesus gradually becomes divine, everyone says, look, Jesus is definitely divine. You know, whether you put that with pre-existence during his life or in resurrection, he's definitely divine. In what sense? And then right. You've got the begotten, unbegotten characteristics. But then people want to say, well, look, there's other divine beings in antiquity.
Mm-hmm.
You've got like, you know, Zeus.
Right.
You've got what some Greek philosophers called the Logos, which seems to be like a divine word or a divine rationality. You've got the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament. You've got a deified Roman emperor. You've got someone like, you know, Heracles, or you've got an Asclepius like that, or an Apollo. So, I mean, with all these different divine beings floating around the world of gods and men, is there one that Jesus is very much an analog to? And people want to ask, is there one that's a kind of template mm-hmm. that the church built its own claim about Jesus's divinity? And here's the problem. If you do a comparison or a contrast, you can find out Jesus is very similar to these intermediary figures. And he can also be very different
right.
to some of these intermediary figures. And I take a line from a chap called David Litwa. He's an American scholar who resides in Melbourne, Australia. And I think he's got a good line. He says, if you focus on just similarities, you end up with parallelomania,
yeah.
just saying this is the same of that.
Mm-hmm.
But what you can really do is flattening out the distinctives or overlooking the differences.
Right.
Okay, so if you just focus on similarities, it's this, you know, parallelomania game of saying this is constantly that. But if you focus on differences, you can end up really just doing apologetics, saying, oh, well, you know, Jesus is nothing like Zeus or the divine Augustus. But the fact is, there really are some similarities, and even some of the church fathers pointed this out in like the second century. I mean, they were constantly trying to say, well, you know, he's divine, but he's not divine like that.
Yeah, right.
But he's having to say that because people are pointing out, oh, yeah, Jesus just looks like a, you know, deified Caesar, or the ascension is kind of like the apotheosis, I mean, the deification of a Roman emperor.
Right.
So you've got both things happening. And there are a couple of interesting figures to look at. I think looking at the Enochic Son of Man.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for those who don't know, there is a book called The Parables of Enoch, which describes this sort of mysterious figure
mm-hmm.
who seems to be, you know, enthroned beside God and is very similar to what Jesus looks like in the eschatological discourse of Matthew's gospel and big parts of the book of Revelation. So is Jesus divine in the same way as this incredible Son of Man figure that you get in the parables of Enoch? So I thought that was very interesting. And there are a lot of similarities between those two figures. I think that the big difference is Jesus seems to participate in the creation-creature distinction, which the Enochic Son of Man never really does. But I mean, if you read the parables of Enoch and then you read the book of Revelation, you'll go between them, think, oh, this reminds me of that, and see how they're using this. They're both using Psalm 2
right.
to say something about this amazing figure.
Right.
So I think the Enochic Son of Man is definitely one who's interesting. And the other one, you know, more generally, is angels. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So if you read something like the Epistle of Jude, where it says, you know, how Jesus saved the people, you know, back in the Exodus. That seems to be Jude identifying Jesus with the angel of the Lord.
Right.
And, I mean, there's a long tradition of regarding the angel of the Lord as a type of Christophany,
mm-hmm.
which is an appearance of the pre-incarnate Jesus, not becoming man, but taking on a type of angelic form, which is, you might call it like a celestial appearing human being,
right.
you know, that kind of thing. And there's other texts, like in the book of Revelation, on the one hand, Jesus is the Lamb of God who sits on the very throne
right.
with God. He receives divine worship.
Right.
He exercises various divine functions. He's clearly on the divine, unbegotten side of the ledger. And yet, he can also be described with angelic characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
He can be described very similar to angels that you find in the books of Ezekiel or the books of Daniel. So Jesus appears to be both an angelic figure, but also an absolutely divine figure. Mm-hmm. And then you go into further literature in the second and third centuries, where there's a lot of describing Jesus as, you know, an angel who descended through the various ranks of angels to become human and then ascended back through those ranks and orders of angels when he ascended into heaven. So they're the kind of interesting similarities that you find, but you've got to look at each one at its own terms and say, okay, this is similar, this is different, and this is why they're different.
Yeah, and one of the things that was really interesting, I think, because you've done a lot of legwork here by looking at each of these instances and trying to, as clearly as possible, put what we have in the New Testament in comparison to them, and especially with the Greco-Roman ones, with the Greco-Roman ones, you note that when they are distinct, it's usually in a distinctly Jewish way. Could you say a little more about that?
Yeah, I think Jesus is a Jewish deity of the Greco-Roman world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there are similarities between Jesus and Greco-Roman deities. I mean, because people are talking about the divine in the same language, using the same cultural encyclopedia, the same sort of suite of ideas and concepts for explaining a deity, but it's being filtered primarily through a Jewish matrix. And so let me give you the best example of that. The best example of that would be the book of Hebrews. Now, this is a book that clearly has some affinity with Platonic philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is a book that's written in Greek.
Right.
This is a book that is well-versed in Hellenistic rhetoric, the way of arguing a point, trying to be persuasive. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's very much a work of the Hellenistic world, mm-hmm. The book of Hebrews. And yet, 25% of the book's contents comes from the Septuagint, which is the Old Testament in Greek. 25%.
Right.
And so when it's describing Jesus, it's largely using a vast array of quotations, citations, and echoes we get of the Old Testament. So that seems to be the primary matrix that Jesus is thought of as a divine person, a divine agent, a divine figure of antiquity. It's not siloed away neatly from the Greco-Roman world, but it is thoroughly embedded in its Jewish context.
So part of your book's goal is to say something along the lines of the New Testament texts are concerned about divine ontology in a way that shows that when the 4th, 5th, 6th century creeds, statements, etc. about Christology come around, they're not introducing something entirely new. So let's just you kind of hinted at this at various points, but let's just kind of get this on the table. In the New Testament, is Jesus a God, or did he really become God in the 4th century?
Well, the answer to that question is he's definitely God. And I think in the New Testament, I mean, it depends which book you're reading, but he's regarded as a pre-existent divine being, pre-existent God, becomes human, and then ascends back to heaven. I mean, that's the overall, mm-hmm. we could call that the kerygmatic narrative, narrative of the gospel, if you like. And the real burden of my song is some of the ontological language, like Jesus is true God of true God, begotten, not made. I mean, you find that in the creeds of the church. You find that in the church fathers. That doesn't happen in a second or third century with a big bang, okay?
Right.
Because some scholars want to say, well, Jesus he's kind of divine. He's got divine functions. Maybe he receives a bit of divine worship. But he's not divine in the same way as the God of Israel, because all that stuff of putting Jesus as equal to God the Father, that happens much later. That's where the church, drunk on Greek philosophy, abandons the language and the lexicon of Scripture and starts using Greek philosophical categories to describe. But that all happens later. That happens later. And my point is, no.
Right.
It doesn't happen. And let me give you an example. So let's take what's commonly called the Christ hymn in Philippians 2, 6 to 11. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's really a hymn, but it's neither here nor there. So Jesus is described as being. That's an ontological word,
Yeah.
Upako. He is being in the form of God.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's the outward expression of a divine form, but that's an outward expression of what something actually is.
Right.
Okay. And I think the form of God is put in parallel to equality with God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I think this is ontological language, and then you can appreciate what the early church was trying to do. They want to say, okay, what's a way of saying Jesus is equal with God in his very being,
mm-hmm.
but what's the type of way of saying that you can't kind of, you know, make it a bit of a fudge and make it mean six different things?
Right.
Because it's a lot of the people in the early church, you know, various different movements, whether the Valentinians, what we call Gnostics or Ebionites or Adoptionists, they could all say, I believe Jesus is divine,
right.
but in what sense?
Mm-hmm.
So the early church, when they were reading scripture like Philippians 2, they said, okay, he's in the form of God. He has equality with God in his very being. Now, what's a word we can use to say that
right.
where you can't fudge it? And that's where they came up with the word homoousios,
mm-hmm.
of the same substance. Now, that's not a word found in Scripture,
sure,
but that's a philosophical concept trying to express what we see as the biblical judgments laid out in this case, the Christ hymn of Philippians 2. So the early church's ontological language, things like, you know, homoousios, of the same substance, that was a way of trying to summarize the type of ontology, the type of divine nature that is ascribed to Jesus already within the New Testament.
Mike Bird, thank you so much for joining us. I'll look forward to seeing how this book is received more broadly, and great work.
Well, thank you, Zen, for having me, and a big hello to all your listeners. I hope you've enjoyed this time.
It was such a good time getting to talk with Mike Bird. His book was one of Baylor Press's biggest sellers at AARSBL. If you picked it up, let us know what you think of it. You can find us on Twitter at @CIRBaylor. Now, Dave Nelson, the director of Baylor Press, is going to introduce you to another Baylor Press author.
You're listening to The Elevator Speech, an occasional feature of Currents in Religion, a Baylor Religion Department and Baylor University Press podcast. I'm your host, Dave Nelson, director of Baylor University Press. Today on The Elevator Speech, we're joined by Paul J. DeHart, professor of theology at Vanderbilt Divinity School and author of Unspeakable Cults, an Essay in Christology, released last fall by Baylor University Press. Paul, thanks for being with us today. What's your elevator speech for Unspeakable Cults? What's the big idea?
So the work springs from the conflict between the modern historical worldview with its relativistic assumptions and methods, and the classical Christian assertion of the absolute status of Jesus of Nazareth as God's saving incarnation in history. The conflict is thus between, on the one hand, faith's claim that one historical fact, or cluster of facts, has unlimited and decisive significance for all human beings, and, on the other hand, the modern historical premise that reduces the significance of all facts to their locations and interrelations and generates a practice of historical judgment which must assess all factual claims in terms of plausible local causal interactions. So the book is a kind of experimental resolution of this tension, based on the surmise that a proper understanding of God's incarnation as an historical human being, which I believe is indispensable for Christian faith, can be made compatible with the modern discovery of history, which I believe is a precious legacy that must be preserved. So, over the course of three parts, the book offers a complicated argument that an understanding of Jesus's factual history is possible, and a model of the relation of divine causation to historical causation is feasible, that could, in combination, allow the affirmation of Jesus's divinity without proposing a miraculous rupture of the world's imminent causal patterns. Now, in the first part, the book identifies classic articulations of the conflict between Christology and history in 19th century German thought, especially Ernst Troeltsch and David Friedrich Strauss. and then draws on the history of religions to briefly suggest possible relevant motifs in first century culture that mitigate the tension between Jesus' humanity and his deified status in early Christianity. This overcomes a preliminary stumbling block, suggesting the tenability in purely historical terms of a scenario in which Jesus himself evinced a deifying self-understanding, whose cultural categories were similar in kind to those deployed by the communities that came to worship him. In the second part, the heart of the argument, the book appropriates ideas from Thomas Aquinas in order to construct a model for understanding the eternal Word's presence in a human being as a thoroughly historical and cultural occurrence, but one dependent at every point on divine power. This power is conceived in terms of quasi-formal causality rather than in terms of supposedly intervening acts of efficient causality. The result might be called a pneumatology of incarnation as cultural event, again, seeking to undermine any strict opposition between Jesus' absolute status and the relativistic assumptions of historicism. The final part deals with the resulting challenges to traditional belief resulting from this proposed model, including the irremediable ambiguity of Jesus' performances of signs and wonders, namely, that faith cannot demand that these be miracles in the strict sense, and the constitutively unfinished nature of his human identity, namely, that because of his divinity, Jesus must be a blurred or unfinished human fact, continually rediscovered by the interpretive work of his ecclesial body in history. I argue, drawing on Kierkegaard and Bonhoeffer, that this ambiguity and this incompleteness of Jesus should be seen not as scandals of modern consciousness, but rather as necessary aspects of the offense that has always confronted faith in Jesus as God. The result of the book's experiment can be seen as an application of the spirit of Chalcedon to the historical imagination. The Christ event may be enchanted history, but it is not composed of enchanted facts.
A fascinating argument. And an outstanding Baylor University Press book. Thank you, Paul, for sharing your elevator speech with us.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to The Elevator Speech, an occasional feature of Currents in Religion, a Baylor Religion Department and Baylor University Press podcast. I'm Dave Nelson, director of Baylor University Press, and my guest today has been Paul J. DeHart, author of Unspeakable Cults, an essay in Christology, now available from Baylor University Press.
Hey again, Zen here. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Currents in Religion, a podcast from Baylor University's Religion Department and Baylor University Press. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with some friends who might like it too. It'd also be a great help if you leave a review so that we know how we're doing. Until next time, take care.